From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Clint Eastwood talks about his movies. He directed the new movie, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which opens today. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Eastwood's new movie and the new Francis Ford Coppola film, The Rainmaker. And we remember rock critic Robert Palmer, who died yesterday at the age of 52. He was the New York Times' first full-time pop music critic. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. UN weapons inspectors returned to Baghdad today after a three-week standoff with Iraq. The inspectors, including Americans, are to resume their work tomorrow. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Cairo.
After a short flight from Bahrain, the inspectors arrived at about noon local time. Their plane landed at a military airport 80 miles outside of Baghdad. Now that they are back on Iraqi soil, the inspectors say their first priority is to determine what has happened in their absence, whether Iraq has moved any materials or records, or tampered with the dozens of video cameras that monitor weapon sites throughout the country. The weapons inspections could resume as early as tomorrow. Iraqi officials say, as far as they're concerned, the three-week-old crisis is now over. But U.S. and U.N. officials say they're not so sure. They're waiting to see if Iraq does, in fact, allow the weapons inspectors to do their job. Eric Weiner, NPR News, Cairo.
Civil rights groups have agreed to fund the settlement of a major affirmative action test case that had been slated for argument before the Supreme Court in January. The school board in Piscataway, New Jersey, voted this morning to settle the case in which race was used as a tiebreaker to decide which of two experienced teachers would be laid off. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The black teacher was kept on in the name of preserving a racially diverse faculty, but two lower courts ruled that race can never, ever be used as a factor in employment except to remedy a proven history of racial discrimination. With the high court closely divided on the issue, civil rights groups began looking for a way out. And in secret negotiations this week, they agreed to pay $308,000 to help settle the case and get it off the Supreme Court calendar. Under the terms of the settlement ratified by the school board today, Sharon Taxman, the white teacher, will be paid $186,000 in back pay plus attorney's fees for a total of $433,000. Of that amount, 70% will be paid by the Black Leadership Forum, a coalition of civil rights groups. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton today signed a bill designed to reform the Food and Drug Administration. The measures include faster approval for new drugs and making it easier for doctors and their patients suffering from diseases like cancer and AIDS to get experimental drugs.
We know that for many patients, experimental treatments represent their best, perhaps their only chance for recovery. That's why this bill writes into law current FDA policies that allow doctors and patients to use new drugs before they are formally approved.
The FDA reforms won wide support in Congress, though it took 3 years to finalize the details. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 28.60 points at 7854.71. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed. At noon, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 29 points at 7854. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are expressing hope of progress in resolving the financial crisis in Asia. South Korea, the world's 11th largest economy, has asked the International Monetary Fund for help in propping up its ailing economy with a $20 billion line of emergency credit. Such a move would in turn reduce pressure on Japan's troubled financial system. As a result, the major equity markets around the world moved higher overnight, optimism which in turn helped to boost Wall Street. I'm Doug Krisner.
The chairman and CEO of IBM says he's remaining at his current job for another 5 years. Louis Gerstner, Jr. has held the top job at IBM since 1993. Gerstner tells the Wall Street Journal he considers his job at IBM only half finished, that he wants to move the computer maker from strength to leadership. Gerstner is 55 years old. Prior to IBM, he was chairman of RJR Nabisco for 4 years. Information technology company BDM International is being purchased by TRW, which offered $29.50 per share. The deal is potentially worth $980 million. BDM had annual revenues of about $1 billion last year and employs 9,000 people worldwide. Sport utility buyers will soon have a four-wheel drive Cadillac model from which to choose. General Motors says its Cadillac division will begin selling a luxury SUV in the 1999 model year. I'm Dave Mattingly, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Keep moving, moving, moving. Oh, they're disapproving. Keep them doggies moving, Lord.
I've been a fan of Clint Eastwood ever since he started herding cattle on the TV western Rawhide. When he teamed up with Italian director Sergio Leone for the spaghetti westerns A Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Eastwood began his transformation from actor to icon.
Listen, stranger. Didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
You see, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you men fired those shots at his feet. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize...
I don't think it's nice you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
After Eastwood reworked the Western genre, he revitalized cop movies with his Dirty Harry series.
I know what you're thinking, punk. You're thinking, did he fire six shots or only five? Now, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and will blow your head clean off, you gotta ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
After years as an action hero blowing people away on screen, Clint Eastwood directed and starred in the movie Unforgiven, which reflected on the cost of violence.
It's a hell of a thing killing a man. You take away all he's got, and all he's ever gonna have.
Clint Eastwood's latest movie opened today. He directed the adaptation of the bestseller Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview recorded 1 year ago with Eastwood and Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who had just written a biography of Eastwood. Eastwood got his first big break with Rawhide on television. He played Rowdy Yates, the young assistant to the trail boss. Eastwood used to call the character Rowdy Yates' trail flunky and Rowdy Yates' idiot of the plains. I told Eastwood that judging from the biography, I probably liked Rawhide a lot more than he did.
Actually, I liked the role. It was we just used to sit around the set and use self-demeaning kind of humor as a way of keeping our sanity out there doing a series week in, week out. I think that... Eric Fleming used to call himself Mr. Failure instead of Mr. Favier, and I used to call myself Rodney Yates Trail Flunky. And we'd just kind of, just joke about it. It was nothing that nobody disliked the series particularly. We just had, it was just kind of a way, and somebody picked up on it, I guess, is that it was a total unhappiness. It wasn't unhappiness, it was just kind of a way that to keep yourself amused, I suppose. Eventually, when you do a series, after the years go by, you do start to get frustrated. You'd like to go on and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm no exception in that case.
I think, too, that Rowdy was, boyish beyond his years toward the end of the series. I think maybe that Clint wanted to be, a somewhat more dangerous figure, thus a more interesting figure to act. I mean, I'm kind of guessing there based on some of our conversations, but I think, any actor trapped in a role that seems to be relatively unchanging is eventually going to say, how come I don't get to, mm-hmm. romp and stomp a little bit?
Well, Clint Eastwood, you started your career as a contract player at Universal Studios in the kind of last gasp of the studio system. Were you being groomed for a particular type of role? Did they see you as a type?
No, they didn't see me hardly at all. they put people under contract in those days, then they promptly forget about them and hire back people that they'd had under contract in previous years. But I don't think I was being groomed for anything. They just were taking a shot, and there you are, and they put you in for 6 months or a year. You had an option every 6 months on these type of terms, and so they could drop you at any time. And they give you a quick evaluation after a year and say, well, maybe you're okay, maybe you're going to go somewhere, or maybe they put them in a bit part and the person shined. I played a lot of bit parts, but none of them particularly shined at that point.
Did you have any sense that your future was going to be in Westerns and in action films? Did you have a sense of that for yourself?
No, a lot of people thought, well, he's a tall guy, maybe he'd be good in Westerns. For some reason, somebody thinks that Western heroes are tall guys for some reason. That sort of based upon the predecessors of Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, and what have you over the years. But so they thought, well, maybe he'll play in Westerns or what have you. But nobody really knew. No, I was just kind of out there and hanging about, studying acting, and it was a steady job. It was kind of nice at the time.
Many of the roles you've played have been, men who are very strong, but men of few words. And it's ironic that your screen test for Rawhide was a long monologue that you were really uncomfortable with because you were having trouble at the time just remembering all of the words in this long monologue, and you didn't think of that as your strength as an actor. What do you think came through about you, even though you missed some of the words in the monologue?
Well, it was amusing because they told me it was going to be an interview test, and I'd done interview tests before.
This is where you just talk with the director?
Exactly. You just talk with the director, and I dislike those intensely because sometimes they ask you, what's your name? Why did you do this? It's a quick interview, usually by somebody who doesn't know how to do interviews, and you sit there on film and look sort of drop-jawed. But this was a test where they said, here, would you like, how are you at learning lines? I said, pretty good. And the guy said, here, well, here's a whole page of dialogue. Said, could you be ready to do this in a half hour? And so I thought, well, I just take the different beats and play those, and the different changes in the scene, kind of play those up and see how it would go and just use my own words. The director happened to be the writer in that case, and he liked every word that he had written, so he was a little bit taken back. But it worked out all right in the end, because the people who viewed it and made the final decision didn't know the dialogue and could care less. They just wanted to see a look and a certain expression.
Why do you think you've gravitated to parts that are parts of few words? Is it that you don't like to remember or learn lines, or is it a sensibility thing that you gravitate more
toward? No, it's just a sensibility thing. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of Fistful of Dollars, a first feature film I played in.
With Sergio Leone.
With Sergio Leone, that I thought that the character would be much more interesting the less he spoke, the less you knew about him. I thought it would be, he'd be a more interesting character. And that often happens when you're doing a character in a play, that the person who talks the most, after a while, you know, you get tired of hearing the conversation. You want to know what's inside. Sometimes a silent moment, you can set up more of an effect than you can by just rambling on reams of dialogue. But later on, it's changed. My last picture, they couldn't shut me up.
One of the things I noticed that Clint said, and it's in the book, is I think he likes himself as a viewer of movies. He prefers to kind of lean in to hear, you know. I mean, in other words, I think he has a feeling that a little bit of mystery about a character doesn't fully explain himself at every minute, is a character that draws us toward the screen. Whereas if a guy is explaining himself constantly, you know, you sort of say, well, you know, why couldn't I be allowed to figure this out for myself? And you kind of, you know, it can kind of push you back from the screen instead of drawing you in.
Yeah, and Rawhide, too, those years, a lot of times the screenwriting that would come in on those scripts would be very expository. In other words, they felt that they had to explain a lot of things in one scene so they wouldn't have to film other scenes. And you get so tired of reeling out exposition that you felt that this was an opportunity to just use a little bit of economy and see if you could tell a story that way.
Well, in some of your action roles, in some of your westerns and like Dirty Harry films, you not only don't say a lot, but what you do say, you're saying often through clenched teeth, you know, in that really guttural voice. How did you develop that style of speaking?
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that the character just drives you in that. It's a character who is maybe frustrated with the things that the common person on the street are frustrated with, the bureaucracy that we live in, the nightmare that we as a civilization have placed on ourselves. I think this is a person who is frustrated with that, especially if you're trying to solve a case in a limited amount of time. I don't know. It's just the thought of the time.
One of the things that Clint said to me that I thought was interesting and amusing is that, you know, he did five Dirty Harry films. He said, well, the thing about Dirty Harry is he always got the best lines in the movies. I mean, he didn't have the most lines, but, you know, Harry Callahan generally got the topper. You know, the funny, smart, well-turned phrase, some of which have become catchphrases.
Okay, now the onus is on one of you to recite a couple of those phrases.
I am not doing my Clint Eastwood imitation. I'll go ahead, Clint, make her day.
Yeah, the make my day line or the do you feel lucky punk kind of lines were lines that people gravitated towards.
Did you have a sense of that reading the script that, you know, presidents would be, you know, making, you know, improvising on those lines, and that they would just enter the general vocabulary? Could you read a script and say, these lines are going to last beyond the film?
Nobody can say that for sure, but you can kind of find the lines that are sort of squelch lines, the ones that come in and put a topper on it. I think the appeal of some of those early characters was the fact that the man would have the right answer, and it was always usually very terse and kind of right to the point, but with a little bit of humor involved, so that everybody said, God, I would love to be able to do that.
Have you ever been able to do that, have just the right comeback at just the right moment?
Very rarely.
Right. Now, when you're doing a line like Make My Day, and you know, okay, this is a really good line, do you, like, go home and do line readings and go, make my day, make my day, make my day, and just do it over and over until you figure out exactly how you want to do it.
Looking into the bathroom right. mirror and doing some of your best acting.
Are you talking to me?
No, I don't. I don't go over the lines. I don't play them out loud. I'd rather play them for the first time when I do them.
No,
and
really?
I usually do them by the motivation of what the feelings are at the time. So I start them from what the intent is, and then let it kind of go out. It's sort of like a blowing through a trumpet or something. You start, and the sound magnifies as it comes out. If you sit there and practice line readings to yourself, you'll just get confused.
My guests are Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schicko, author of a biography of Eastwood. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schicko, recorded last year. I want to get to your spaghetti westerns, the films you made with Sergio Leone. You started the Sergio Leone films when you were still making Rawhide, the TV western. How did Sergio Leone get to see Rawhide and decide you were the one to star in his western?
He had seen an episode that somebody was showing around, an agency had in Rome, and he had seen an episode, and they thought, well, here's a chance to hire an American actor who has been doing westerns but is not very expensive, and that they didn't have any
right.
they didn't have any money to spend, so they didn't have a lot of choices as far as names of the moment.
What was it like for you to make the transition from upstanding assistant trail boss to mystery western tough guy?
Well, it was great fun because all of a sudden I was playing something completely different than I had been playing, and I got to experiment a lot. I could do we'd do everything with a look. Leone was very visual, and unlike television, where sometimes they just want to shoot talking heads. He was shooting in a very kind of an expansive way, and it was fun. It was also fun to work with a European crew and watch other people who see their approaches to it and how it all unravels from their point of view over there.
There's a lot of really interesting facial close-ups in your movies with Sergio Leone, and he had a very iconographic way of shooting faces, particularly your face. And your face in those close-ups is often, mysterious, unknowable. Instead of the facial close-ups like revealing this essence of who you are, they reveal the unknowability of who you are. And I've always wondered, what were you thinking during those close-ups to get the right expression on your face?
The first response would be to say absolutely nothing to get the... George Cukor used to say he'd tell Greta Garbo sometimes to look into the camera and stare and don't think about a thing. But that's maybe a little oversimplification or a way to get a certain effect out of her at that time. But you think about what you're doing with the plot line, what the demands are of the plot. Usually, because this character, though he wasn't saying a lot, he was plotting a lot. And so you just thought about what your next moves were. It's just a question of thinking like you would in real life. You don't, and you may be thinking, you have an inner monologue. Every actor plays an inner monologue as you're playing your outer character. And sometimes your outer character is saying, good evening, it's wonderful to see you. But underneath you might be saying, yeah, dirty, rotten. So, you know, you really don't... care, and so that's your inner monologue, and so I might have been saying something like that to myself at the time, as you know, You develop- I don't like these guys. I'd like to, you know, blow them all away, but I'd be very pleasant at the moment.
You developed a squint also in some of those clothes.
Well, that was just the sunlight. And
was it?
Yeah. They bomb me with a bunch of lights, and you're outside, and it's 90 degrees. It's hard not to squint.
Richard Schickel, I want to ask you what you think of the importance of the Sergio Leone films in Clint Eastwood's filmmaking career.
Oh, I sort of think that Clint would have made his way into wider public consciousness in some other fashion, but I do also feel that those movies were so singular. They were truly, deeply, profoundly revisionist Westerns, as Clint has often said, at a time when the Western was in a kind of a dull place. The traditions of the Western in America had been kind of used up, and though we were in a period where Westerns were very popular in television and coming out of a period in which they had been very popular in the theaters, nonetheless, you know, the basic Western moves, the traditional moves, had become dull and overused and kind of cliché-ridden, and I think it's one of the things that drew Clint to this was that opportunity, not just for his own character to expand a bit, but for him to participate in a kind of a revision of a form that he actually liked. I mean, it's important to remember that you know, Clint does know quite a bit about film history and so forth. He had seen Yojimbo, the Kurosawa movie, which was a source for this particular movie, for Fistful of Dollars, and he'd seen it 2 years before and had said, hey, this would make a great Western, but I don't think anybody in America will make it because it's too tough. And here were these crazy Italians who were, you know, willing to do exactly that.
Clint Eastwood, since there's been these great iconographic close-ups of your face, I'm wondering what you think of your face as a man, an actor, and as a director, because you've had to work with your face as a director and look at it very objectively, I'd imagine.
As a director, you think of yourself as another character. Well, a lot of times when I'm talking to the editor, I'll say, when he comes in the room and she does this and hey, that goes here and what have you, I never think of myself in the first person. It's just you have to do that. And, you know, you don't dwell on your face. You dwell on the fact that you're there and the character. And if you think too much about certain things, you can get yourself very confused. So rather than do that, you just forge right on ahead with what you're doing.
Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schickel recorded a year ago after the publication of Schickel's biography of Eastwood. Eastwood directed the new movie Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which opens today. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and Rising Tide Entertainment, featuring the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's new release, The Christmas Album, available at record stores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Clint Eastwood and his biographer Richard Schickel. John Powers reviews Eastwood's new movie, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and Francis Ford Coppola's new film, The Rainmaker. And we remember music critic Robert Palmer, who died yesterday.
Hey!
This is Fresh Air, our weekly archive edition. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Clint Eastwood and Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who wrote a biography of Eastwood, which was published a year ago when we recorded our interview. When we left off, we were talking about Eastwood's spaghetti westerns directed by Sergio Leone. Now, in Richard Schickel's book about you, he says that, Rawhide followed the strict production code of the time. You couldn't show a fired gun and the victim of the bullet in the same shot. There had to be an edit in between. What was your reaction to Sergio Leone's really vivid approach to violence?
Well, that was true. The Hays office at that time had a rule for Westerns only, ironically, and you couldn't show the shootee and the shooter in the same shot. It couldn't be a tie-up shot, in other words. So you'd have to do it as an individual cut. And if you look at even later American Westerns of High Noon, you won't see the tie-up. But Sergio didn't know about all that, and I wasn't about to tell him because I was really enjoying this. It was breaking all, we were trying to break all the molds. And in breaking all the molds, it made those pictures a hit, or as somewhat of a revisionist idea, or certainly an outsider's point of view. They became popular, but they also brought with it some resentment, as you and Richard touched on earlier in the show. There were a lot of people felt, Maybe who was this upstart? We didn't come in and bless this guy to come along, and we didn't bless these movies to come along, an Italian interpretation of the great American genre. So there was a certain resentment that hung around with those pictures for some time. Now, as people look back on them, they enjoy the fact that there was a different it was a different period, and then it went on to somebody else. And Sam Peckinpah came along later, and he did another look at the Western. And someone else comes along and does another one. And I come back to him and take another shot. And somebody else down the line, that way it keeps a great American art form alive.
The first Dirty Harry film was directed by Don Siegel, who you did several films with, including Coogan's Bluff, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, The Beguiled. What are some of the things you feel you learned about acting and directing from your association with him?
Well, directorially, he was a terribly efficient man who'd come up through the ranks, started out with a montage department at Warner Brothers many years before. He'd done quite a few second vision films, or B-movies, he used to call. Some of them quite good, some of them classics, like Invasion of the Body Snatcher. And he was terribly efficient, because he had to be. He never had the luxury of the big budgets and that some other directors might have had. And he was terribly underrated, because he could make a lot happen with very little. And so you learned how a person could go to work every day and be efficiently turn out a certain amount of work. I had worked with other directors like that. I'd worked with directors like that in television, mm-hmm, some of them mm-hmm. really quite good. But Don had never really captured the mainstream of the of Hollywood. I guess maybe because he was sort of a cantankerous guy and he sort of marched to his own drummer. But he, what you learn from somebody like that is, you don't have to sit and dwell and
be the great artiste.
You can be an artist, but not an artiste.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
The first Dirty Harry film was very controversial. A lot of people saw it as a cop who was a real law and order, right-wing kind of cop. Don't worry about reading somebody their rights. Don't worry about obeying the law. Just make the collar and, get them behind bars. Paul Newman apparently turned down the role for political reasons. What did you see, Clint Eastwood? What did you see in this role when you took it on? What interested you in the character?
I saw an exciting detective story. I saw a script that was concerned about the victims of violent crime rather than the accused, so that was an interesting way to go. There was no big call to drop all the rights of the accused of crime or anything like that. It just happened to be a frustrating situation, all set up by the Harry Julian Fink script of the fact that there was a time element in having to solve the case. There's nothing right-wing about that. There's nothing... they weren't intended to be that way. Don Siegel and myself just saw it as a chance to do an exciting film. If somebody wanted to politicize it, that's fine. There's a couple comments about Miranda and a few decisions like that, but I think there's been, in recent years, some discussion about that, maybe some of those decisions are not always practical. That's the way it is. I think the blue-collar person out there, the Mr. and Mrs. Middle America who sit there and we're watching the press being constantly concerned with the accused and never once thinking about victims, saw this movie as somewhat of a breath of fresh air. Since that movie and that time, we're in another era now where they have victims' rights organizations and all kinds of attention put upon that. But at that particular time, nobody had the imagination to picture themselves the victim of a violent crime.
Did you feel misunderstood?
It was misunderstood. It wasn't misunderstood. I think the public didn't misunderstand it at all. I think it was misunderstood by some people who felt that you had to put a political connotation to absolutely every film that's made, and sometimes there are times when you have to rely on the old Alfred Hitchcock adage that it's only a movie.
Clint Eastwood, I thought that your choice of directing and starring in The Unforgiven was such an interesting choice, because it's a movie about a man who goes from bad man to good man to myth. And it's also interesting because it's about the difficulty of killing someone and what it takes out of you when you do kill someone. And you'd been in so many mythic movies and been in so many movies where the character that you played killed a lot of people. So I'm interested in how you related to the story in The Unforgiven and how it dealt with myth-making and with violence.
Well, those exact things that you mentioned are what attracted me to the project, the fact that... but even though I had done pictures where I've been a police officer and Western films where I've had a lot of gunplay and stuff, it's not that I approved of that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily approve of the romanticizing of gunplay, and I don't think it's... and I thought here was a chance, here was a story that had... that sort of shot holes in that, if you'll pardon the pun, you know, it brought out the truth about gunplay and the fact that there is some loss to your soul when you commit an act of violence, and to play a person who was deeply affected in his life because of some of the mayhem that he'd been responsible for was to me made the character more interesting. It was more interesting for me to play, and in fact, I never thought the film would be really commercial when I was making it, because it had all these statements about mayhem and violence, and I thought maybe this might not be a straight ahead action movie that people wanted, but I liked the story and I felt it was worth telling.
My guests are Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schickel, author of a biography of Eastwood. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schickel, recorded last year. Well, Clint Eastwood, I feel like I must talk with you a little bit about music. And to kick off this chapter of our interview, let's listen to this.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me saddle my old saddle underneath the west.
Terry, you should have seen the pain in this room, right?
And that's from the album Clint Eastwood Sings Cowboy Favorites. And there's a picture of Clint Eastwood as Rowdy Yates on the cover. Rawhide's Clint Eastwood singing.
That was yeah. I was the Milli Vanilli of the moment there. I did, that wasn't me.
Oh yes, it was. I actually like your singing voice. I really do. I mean, this is a strange album with strange arrangements and not always good songs. But I really like your singing, and I imagine you're also like influenced by Chet Baker in your singing. And
well, that wasn't first place. That wasn't the kind of songs that I would normally like to sing.
The songs on here, I'd imagine not. Yeah. But you got to sing Cole Porter. Don't fence me in.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cole Porter is certainly wonderful. But what happened is that somebody had the brilliant idea that that I should do some cowboy songs, not country western songs, Nashville type, but real straight cowboy songs. And I wasn't sure whether I liked the idea, but they said, well, we'll do it, and we have a session tomorrow. And I said, well, not tomorrow, I'm leaving. Well, will you do it? You just stop by the studio on the way to the airport. So I did a whole album. You think about people who take 6 months to make an album, but this one, that we did the whole album in one session, and I didn't know the songs. I had to come in and learn them real quick, and some of them I knew, some songs like that you've heard as a child, but you don't really know them. And so it was a little frustrating. It wasn't my favorite musical experience in life, but it was, there again, you learn something every day.
Now, had you sung much before? Did you think of yourself as a singer at all?
Not really. I'd done a few things. I'd done a few records. I'd been involved in music, so I could sometimes carry a tune. My father loved singing. He had a group that played, and he loved to sing all the time. He would love to have been a singer more than anything, I think.
Now, I know you're still, and were as a young man, very passionate about jazz. Did you ever think that you'd become a professional musician instead of an actor and director?
Well, I thought about that earlier when I was a kid and I was doing things, but I never thought, I never really knew what I wanted to do until I became an actor. And at that point, I kind of knew which direction I was going to at least make get up and swing at the bat.
Would you like to sing more or play more? Or?
No, I don't have any there's one of my key sayings.
Yes.
A man must know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schickel recorded last year after the publication of Schickel's biography of Eastwood. Eastwood directed the new movie adaptation of the bestseller Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. The soundtrack features songs by Johnny Mercer. Clint Eastwood sings one of them.
You got an accent, you ate the positive and elim, and ate the negative and latch on to the affirmative and don't mess with Mr. in between. You gotta spread joy up to the maximum and bring gloom down to the minimum and have faith or pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark, Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark. What did they do just when everything looked so dark? Man, they said we better accentuate the positive and healing, and ate the negative and latch on to the affirmative and don't mess with Mr. in between.
But Clint Eastwood isn't the only director with a new movie adaptation of a bestseller. Francis Ford Coppola's new adaptation of the John Grisham novel The Rainmaker also opened today. Both films center on a court case. Our film critic John Powers has his own verdict.
John Barron's book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, has been on the bestseller list for the last 174 weeks, and it's easy to see why. It's a journey into the culture of Savannah, Georgia, a provincial city that's like a petri dish for colorful characters. Barrett wanders among these people, recording their talk and observing their rituals. He doesn't try to funnel their lives into one neat storyline. But Hollywood demands such funneling. And these days, when screenwriters can't figure out how to do it, they tend to plop you down in a courtroom. That's precisely what happens in Clint Eastwood's eagerly anticipated screen adaptation. John Cusack plays a New York writer who's come to Savannah to do a story on the annual Christmas party held by Jim Williams, a gay antiques dealer played by Kevin Spacey. The night of the party, Williams shoots his street hustler lover. And though this murder isn't a tenth as interesting as the average court TV case, the trial takes over the movie as it never did the book. Barrett knows that everything interesting about Savannah lies outside the courthouse walls. Here we feel stuck inside them. The movie's best in the opening minutes, when Cusack's character first encounters the strange Savannah where men walk invisible dogs. But even here, Eastwood lets us down. He has little gift for the precise social observation that would make Savannah come alive. Where Berendt's book is like a wonderful piece of anthropology, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil seems like a southern version of Twin Peaks or Northern Exposure. It makes everybody quirky or cute. While I'd approached Eastwood's movie with excitement, I'd had almost no hopes at all for The Rainmaker, or to use the correct title, John Grisham's The Rainmaker. What is it with these people? I mean, you don't hear it called God's the Bible. Then again, God's ego is a lot smaller than John Grisham's. The Rainmaker's story comes straight from Grisham's bologna slicer. Matt Damon plays Rudy Baylor, an idealistic young lawyer who represents a poor leukemia victim. He's suing a crooked insurance company whose executives look as if they've swum to the courtroom through an ocean of frying oil. When Rudy's not in court, he becomes guardian angel to a young woman played by Claire Danes, whose husband beats her with an aluminum baseball bat. Although this storyline could hardly be more predictable, what I wouldn't have predicted is that the movie would be so thoroughly entertaining. Like a Hollywood director from the 40s or 50s, filmmaker Francis Coppola takes a stew of cliches and gives it an unexpected richness and flavor. Playing against Grisham's cheap moralism, bringing out the story's dark comedy, and winning sharp performances from his whole cast. The movie's bursting with amusing characters. Mickey Rourke as a racketeer named Bruiser, John Voight as the insurance company's smugly cynical attorney, and Danny Glover as a flagrantly liberal judge. The best wisecracks come from Rudy's sidekick, Deck, played by Danny DeVito, who teaches Rudy how a lawyer hustles business.
In law school, Rudy, they don't teach you what you need to know. It's all theories and lofty notions and big fat ethics books.
What's wrong with ethics?
Nothing, I guess. I mean, I believe a lawyer should fight for his client, refrain from stealing money, and try not to lie. You know, the basics.
That was blatant ambulance chasing.
Right. Who cares? There's a lot of lawyers out there. It's a marketplace. It's a competition. What they don't teach you in law school can get you hurt.
The Rainmaker is a remarkable comeback for Coppola, whose last movie, Jack, was so terrible that I wondered if he'd ever make anything good again. Perhaps he wondered, too, for he's really concentrating here. This is the best directing he's done since the second Godfather film. The whole movie is lucid, precise, perfectly paced, and shot on a marvelously moody widescreen by John Toll. Against all odds, The Rainmaker succeeds precisely where Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil fails. Where Eastwood takes an atmospheric character study and turns it into a boring story about a trial, Coppola takes a boring story about a trial and fills it with atmosphere and characters who keep making you laugh.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Coming up, we remember music critic Robert Palmer, who died yesterday. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're going to remember music critic Robert Palmer, who died yesterday at the age of 52. He had liver disease and had been awaiting a liver transplant. Palmer was the New York Times' first full-time pop music critic. He was at the Times from 1981 to 88. Palmer was also the author of books about Jerry Lee Lewis, the Blues, the Rolling Stones, and the songwriting team of Lieber and Stoller. As his fellow music critic John Pareles wrote in the Times obituary today, Palmer mixed vivid musical insight with broader cultural and historical connections. He celebrated music for its rule-breaking spirit, far-flung roots, stubborn characters, and untamed noise. Robert Palmer was chief advisor to the PBS series Rock and Roll: An Unruly History and wrote the companion book. I spoke with him in 1995 about his first encounter with rock and roll.
I think everybody has their own rock and roll history, you know, that starts with the first music that they heard, and it develops not always in a linear progression, but sometimes going back into history as well as forward, you know. I mean, a lot of people come in at the point of listening to some contemporary artist and then sort of gradually get into discovering the roots, you know, possibly starting with the influences of the person that they first got turned on to. I think everybody has that magic moment when the music rocked them for the first time.
And what was yours?
Mine would probably be the first Coasters hit record, Searchin' and Youngblood. I remember that coming on when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I had been hearing pre-rock and roll popular music on the radio for a few years prior to that, and I was very interested in music, but I wasn't that crazy about what was passing for pop music at the time. And then when I heard Searchin' by the Coasters, and a little after that I heard Ray Charles, and that was the music that really turned me around.
What spoke to you about it?
It's really hard to say. I think it was really the quality of the voices. It was the fact that these black singers, there was all these grit in their voices, and these kind of sounds like they were maybe ripping their vocal cords a little bit when they were singing. And it seemed to convey so much emotion and energy and excitement, you know, just the sound of the voices and the texture of the voices, and the way that the voices blended together had a kind of harmony that was not conventional harmony. It was something else. And it was, after having heard very conventional harmony, you know, all my life, having never heard blues or even any really down-home country and western music, but just kind of having heard that 50s white bread pop, the first time I heard black voices and black rhythms, I was just floored. And I probably never got over it.
Why don't we play the Coasters?
Okay, great.
Gonna find her. Gonna find her. Gonna find her. Gonna find her.
Yeah, I've been searching. I'm searching. Oh, yeah. Searching every which way. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Searching.
Robert Palmer, you grew up in Arkansas, and near Little Rock, is that?
In Little Rock. Yeah.
Okay. And when you were coming of age, it was still segregated, I guess.
Very much so. I personally integrated in reverse all the black rhythm and blues shows that came to the auditorium in Little Rock starting when I was 15 years old, and that was in 1960. There were no integrated shows in Arkansas, and I was the first white kid to start showing up at all the black shows, and it was such a novelty that nobody thought to stop me, even though I was only 15 years old and I was going in these places where people were drinking and pulling knives and all sorts of things, you know. But I was able to go in and hear people like Sam Cooke and, you know, Otis Redding, Solomon Burke, all these great, great people. And that really was what got me started in the music, was going to those shows. I really rarely missed one. And, you know, by the time I was college age, there were several more local white kids going to the shows, but there was only me to begin with. And then when I was in college, I was the only white musician in an otherwise all-black band that played around almost entirely in black joints. So I had a real sort of involvement in black music and black culture that I really think it was possible because I grew up in Arkansas at that particular time. And all of those developments, I was, you know, right on the cutting edge. I've been around long enough that I was able to be first with all that kind of stuff in town. And consequently, I didn't really ever have much trouble, you know, getting into those shows. It was several years later that I first started going to White Rock shows, probably about 1965, before I ever went to a Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, and that was to see the Yardbirds.
No, I grew up in Brooklyn and used to go to see the Murray the K rock and roll shows. Murray the K was a great New York disc jockey. And there'd be a mix of acts, or black acts and white acts sharing the same bill, and lots of black teenagers and white kids in the audience, and I guess there was nothing like that when you were growing up in
Arkansas. Well, that was the great promise of rock and roll, that it was supposed to be like that, you know. And I think that it was small independent labels that were putting out most of the music in the 50s, and, you know, as soon as the sort of major corporate labels could reassert control, it went back to being segregated shows again. I mean, the shows that I saw in Little Rock were shows that were all black acts and were for black people only. And yet, if I had been going to those shows in the mid-50s and seeing a lot of the same artists, and it had been Brooklyn, that would have been billed as a rock and roll show. But below the Mason-Dixon line, it was rhythm and blues and strictly for black people.
Music critic Robert Palmer recorded in 1995. He died yesterday of liver disease at the age of 52. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Katie Balser is our intern. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
It brings a tear into my eyes.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Remy Martin, Cognac, France, since 1724. Information available, 800-678-REMY. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as you plan your Thanksgiving dinner, we'll get advice from two cooks, Madeline Kamen, who has just updated her 1971 book, The Making of a Cook, and Shirley Carrier, an expert on the chemistry of cooking. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.